What dialect is that he speaks? Zuga interrupted within the first few seconds. Chichewa, Camacho replied. He no speak other. Zuga glanced at Robin, but she shook her head. They had to rely entirely on Camacho's rendition of the old man's replies. It seemed that the old man had seen Manali, the man with the red shirt, at Zimi, on the Lualaba River. Manali had been camped there with a dozen porters, and the old man had seen him with his own eyes. How does he know it was my father? Zuga asked. Everybody knew Manali, the old man explained. He was a living legend from the coast to Chonalanga, the land where the sun sets. Where did he see Manali? One moon before the coming of the last rains, which made it in October of the previous year, as Camacho had said, about 8 months previously. Zuga sat lost in thought, but his gaze fixed with such ferocity on the unfortunate who grovelled before him that the old man suddenly burst out a plaintive note that made Camacho's handsome face darken with anger, and he touched the skeletal ribs with the toe of his boot, a threatening gesture that quietened the old man instantly. What did he say? Robin demanded. He swears he speaks the truth only, Camacho assured her, resurrecting his smile with an effort. What else does he know of Manali? Zuga asked. He speak with the porters of Manali. They say they go follow the Lualaba River. It made some sense, Zuga thought. If Fuller Ballantyne was indeed seeking the source of the Nile River to recover his lost reputation, then that is where he would have gone. The Lualaba, which was reputed to run directly northward, was one of the obvious choices for the source river. Camacho questioned the old man for another 10 minutes, and would have taken the hippo hide whip to jog his memory, but Zuga stopped him with a gesture of annoyance. It was obvious that there was nothing further to learn from him. Give him a bolt of Makani cloth and a ket of beads, and let him go, Zuga ordered, and the old man's gratitude was pathetic to watch. Zuga and Robin sat later than usual beside the campfire, while it collapsed slowly upon itself in spasmodic torrents of rising sparks, and the murmur of sleepy voices from the porter's boma died into silence. If we go north, Robin mused, watching her brother's face, we will be going into the stronghold of the slave trade, from Lake Marawi northwards. From that area into which no white man, not even Pater, has ever ventured, must come all the slaves for the markets of Zanzibar and the Omani Arabs. What about the evidence of the trade to the south? Zuga glanced across the clearing at the silent figure of Juba, waiting patiently by the entrance to Robin's tent. That girl is the living proof that a new trade is flourishing south of the Zambezi. Yes, but it seems to be nothing compared to the activity north of here. The northern trade has been fully documented. Father reached Marawi and followed the slave caravans down to the coast 15 years ago, and Bannerman at Zanzibar has written a dozen reports on the Zanzibar market, Zuga pointed out, nursing a precious tumbler of his fast-dwindling supply of whisky and staring into the ashes of the fire. Whereas nobody knows anything about the trade with the Monomotapa and the Matabele south of here. Yes, I acknowledge that, Robin admitted reluctantly. However, in his missionary travels, Father wrote that the Lualaba was the source of the Nile, and he would one day prove it by following it from its headquarters. Besides which, he has been seen in the north. Has he, though? Zuga asked mildly. Well, that old man was lying. Somebody put him up to it. And I don't need more than one guess, Zuga finished. How do you know he was lying? Robin demanded. If you live long enough in India, you develop an instinct for the lie, Zuga smiled at her. Besides, why would Father wait 8 years after he disappeared to explore the Lualaba River? He would have gone there directly, if he had gone north. My dear brother, Robin's voice was stinging, it would not be the legend of Monomotapa that makes you so stubbornly determined to go south of the river, would it? Is that gleam in your eye the gleam of gold? That is a mean thought, Zuga smiled again. But what does intrigue me is the determination of that great guide and explorer, Camacho Pereira, to discourage any journey to the south, and instead to lead us northwards. Long after Robin had disappeared into her tent, and the lantern within was extinguished, Zuga sat on beside the fire, nursing the whisky in the tumbler, and staring into the fading coals. When he reached his decision, he drained the last drop of precious golden brown spirit in the glass and stood up abruptly. He strode down the lines to where Camacho Pereira's tent stood at the furthest end of the camp. There was a lantern burning within, even at this late hour, and when Zuga called out, a squeak of alarm in feminine tones was quickly hushed with a man's low growl, and a few minutes later Camacho Pereira pulled the fly aside and peered out at Zuga warily. He had thrown a blanket over his shoulders to cover his nudity, but in one hand he carried a pistol and relaxed only slightly as he recognized Zuga. "I have decided," Zuga told him brusquely, "that we'll go north, up the Shire River to Lake Marawi, and then on to the Lualaba River." Camacho's face shone like the full moon as he smiled.
"That is very good. Very good. Much ivory. We find your father. You see, we find him damn soon."
Before noon the following day, Camacho, with a great deal of shouting and swishing of the kerbash, marched 100 strong, healthy men into the camp.
"I find you porters," he announced. "Plenty porters. Damn good, eh?"
The Christian girl Sarah was waiting beside the grave again when Robin came down through the acacia forest the following afternoon. The child saw her first and ran to greet her. He was laughing with pleasure, and Robin was struck once again by the familiarity of his face. It was something about his mouth and his eyes. The resemblance to somebody she had known was so forcible that she stopped dead and stared at him, but could not recapture the memory before the boy took her hand and led her to where his mother waited. They went through the little ritual of changing the flowers on the grave, and then settled side by side on a fallen acacia branch. It was cooler in the shade, and in the branches above their heads a pair of shrikes hunted little green caterpillars. The birds were black and white across the back and wings, but their breasts were a striking shade of crimson that glowed like the blood of a dying gladiator, and Robin watched them with rare pleasure while she and Sarah talked quietly. Sarah was telling her about her mother, how brave and uncomplaining she had been in the terrible heat of the Kabora Bassa, where the black ironstone cliffs turned the gorge into a furnace.
"It was a bad season," Sarah explained. "The hot season before the rains break."
Robin recalled her father's written account of the expedition, in which he had laid the blame for the delays upon his subordinates, Old Harkness and Commander Stone, so that they had missed the cool season and entered the gorge in the suicide month of November.
"Then when the rains came, the fever came with it," Sarah went on. "It was very bad. The white men and your mother became sick very quickly."
Perhaps her mother had lost much of her immunity to malaria during the years in England, while she waited for her husband's summons.
"Even Manali himself became sick. It was the first time I had seen him sick of the fever. He was filled with the devils for many days."
The expression described vividly the delirium of malarial fever, Robin thought.
"So he did not know when your mother died."
They were silent again. The child, bored by the interminable talk of the two women, threw a stone at the birds in the acacia branches above their heads, and with a flash of their marvellous crimson breasts, the two shrikes winged away towards the river. And again the child engaged Robin's attention. It was as if she had known that face all her life.
"My mother?"
Robin asked, still watching the child.
"Her water turned black," said Sarah simply.
The blackwater fever. Robin felt her skin prickle. When malaria changed its course, attacking the kidneys and transforming them into thin-walled sacks of clotted black blood that could rupture at the patient's smallest movement. The blackwater fever. When the urine changed to dark mulberry-coloured blood, and few, very few victims ever recovered.
"She was strong," Sarah went on quietly. "She was the last of them to go."
She turned her head towards the other neglected graves. The curly pods of the acacia were scattered thickly over the unadorned mounds.
"We buried her here while Manali was still with his devils. But later, when he could walk, he came with the book and said the words for her. He built the cross with his own hands.
Then he went away again.
Robin asked.
No, he was very sick, and new devils came to him. He wept for your mother.
The thought of her father weeping was something so completely alien that Robin could not imagine it.
He spoke often of the river that had destroyed him.
Through the acacia trees there were glimpses of the wide green river, and both their heads turned towards it naturally.
He came to hate that river, as though it were a living enemy that had denied him a road to his dreams. He was like a man demented, for the fever came and went. At times he would battle with his devils, shouting his defiance the way a warrior gias at the enemy host. The gia was a challenge dance with which the Nguni warrior baits his adversary. At other times he would speak wildly of machines that would tame his enemy, of walls that he would build across the waters to carry men and ships up above the gorge.
Sarah broke off, her lovely dark moon face stricken with the memory. And the child sensed her distress and came to her, kneeling on the earth and laying his dusty little head in her lap. She stroked the tight cap of curls with an absent-minded caress. With a sudden little chill of shock, Robin recognized the child. Her expression changed so drastically that Sarah followed the direction of her gaze, looking down with all her attention at the head in her lap, then up again to meet Robin's eyes. It did not really need words to pass. The question was posed and answered with silent exchange of feminine understanding, and Sarah drew the child towards her with a protective gesture. It was only after your mother, Sarah began to explain, and then fell silent, and Robin went on staring at the little boy. It was Zuga, at the same age, a dusky miniature Zuga. It was only the colour of his skin which had prevented her from seeing it immediately. Robin felt as though the earth had lurched beneath her feet. Then it steadied again, and she felt a strange sense of release. Fuller Ballantyne was no longer the godlike figure hewn from unforgiving, unbending granite that had overshadowed her entire life. She held out both her hands to the child, and he went to her unhesitatingly, trustingly. Robin embraced him, and his skin was smooth and warm as she kissed him. He wriggled against her like a puppy, and she felt a deep glow of affection and of gratitude to the child. He was very sick, said Sarah softly, and alone. They had all gone or died, and he was sad, so that I feared for his life. Robin nodded understanding. And you loved him? There was no sin in it, for he was a god, said Sarah simply. No, thought Robin with intense relief. He was a man, and I, his daughter, am a woman. In that moment she knew that she never need again feel shame and guilt for her body, and the demands and desires which sprang from it. She hugged the child, who was proof of her father's humanity, and Sarah smiled with relief. For the first time in her life, Robin was able to face the fact that she loved her father, and she understood part of the compulsion that over the years had grown stronger rather than dwindling. The longing she had felt for the father had been submerged completely by the awe and majesty of the legend. Now she knew why she was here, on the banks of this majestic river, on the very frontier of the known world. She had come not to find Fuller Ballantyne, but to discover, rather, the father and the self that she had never known before.
Where is he, Sarah? Where is my father? Which way did he go? She demanded eagerly.
But the woman dropped her eyes.
I do not know, she whispered. I woke one morning, and he was gone. I do not know where he is, but I will wait for him until he returns to me and his son.
She looked up quickly.
He will come back? She asked pathetically. If not to me, then for the child?
Yes, Robin answered with certainty that she did not feel. Of course he will come back,